Hello and welcome to Pedagogzilla, the pedagogic podcast with the pop culture core. Today we are answering the bloody stupid question, how does the Council of Elrond use consocial construct... Today we are answering the bloody stupid question, how does the Council of Elrond use social constructivism to plan the destruction of the One Ring? Hello, I am Mike. I am a senior learning designer at the Open University. I am imposter syndrome incarnate. I am a man who's usually got a very reliable set of microphones and today is having to use the work laptop, and thus far it's being a dick. And joined by...
I'm Mark Childs. I'm a senior learning designer at Durham University and a national teaching fellow. That's going to be my new claim to fame.
that's the new snappy tagline.
Yeah, it's a new snappy tagline. I'm sticking with it.
Okay, then. And I'm Rebecca Ferguson, and I'm a professor at the Open University. And my tagline is Innovator of Pedagogies, because I work on the Innovative Pedagogy Report.
That's a good one. I feel I should drop my self-deprecatory. Everybody else's is just really grandiose. It's like, I'm Mark and I've got a cape. I'm a professor.
I've had to write a special bit into the book about you being imposter syndrome incarnate in the bit about the Dunning-Kruger syndrome.
Yeah.
I had to write a whole extra section for that.
Didn't you get asked for, you were included in some meeting as the pedagogy expert recently?
I was, yeah, that was weird. Nice. It was like, Mike's the pedagogy expert. I went, okay. Anyway, so in this episode, we are looking at, as you may have guessed, social constructivism. It's a biggie. And Lord of the Rings. Let's break the two of them apart in answering our question in the first part of the show.
Part one, the question.
So, how does the Council of Elrond use social constructivism to plan the destruction of the One Ring? Might as well start with a little bit of Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
I think we should do a little bit of background on Mark's interest in this, because Mark has read so much background to this that he's going to have to be reined in throughout the episode.
Yeah, I'm not looking forward to this edit.
Oh, no, on Unfinished Tales. Son, I'll be good.
Lord of the Rings, beloved by nerds for generations, and then beloved by many, many, many more from the early 2000s, where it was probably one of the most successful film franchises ever.
Yeah.
Three absolutely belting movies.
Also, I mean, let's not forget the 70s movie as well.
The animated one, it's glorious.
Yeah, and also...
Perhaps before we leap into the 70s movie, we could just run over what The Lord of the Rings is about. Oh, we're just going to riff around it without telling anybody about it.
It is a fantastic trilogy which follows the travels of Frodo and his pals, Sam, Merry and Pippin. They're all hobbits who are little halfling people who've got a great big hairy feet and really like lots of breakfasts, which we can all relate to. They're brave and adventurous, and they find themselves in possession of the One Ring to rule them all, owned by Sauron, who has a villain who has been destroyed in a previous super epic war, and revealed by Gandalf to be this horrible, smelly, dirty ring. And they then embark on a quest to destroy it. They find friends, colleagues, allies, and enemies on the way, including Aragorn, the cool dude, Strider, with his cool hair. What's his name? Bloke with the axe.
Gimli.
Gets done in at the end of the first book.
Gimli. Oh, Boromir. Gimli the dwarf.
Boromir gets done in at the end of the first one.
Yeah, Boromir. Yeah. Legolas, the drunk elf. They all have a lovely, lovely party and go on to... I'm gonna defer here to somebody who actually remembers better how this all goes.
But I think where we join them is at the point where they've got the ring. There's lots of people from many lands have gathered together at Elrond's hangout, and they're all saying, what's going on? We can see this war coming. We can see this trouble coming. We've all got fragments of a story, but we can't really put it together. So we've all come to Elrond because Elrond always knows the answer to things. Elrond says, right, we'll gather all together in a council, and we will spend the morning sort of sharing our stories. And at the end of that, they work out that what they have is the One Ring, which could either throw everywhere into evil and darkness for thousands of years, or they could destroy it and reshape things. So they get together and decide, yes, we're going to destroy the ring.
Yeah. Or, I mean,
see, Mark is taking a deep breath to leave.
I was going to say there's a slight disagreement in that there's also the possibility of using the ring to defeat Sauron. And that's one or two of the people in the Ret Council believe that is a possibility. But, you know, but then it tends to corrupt people, absolute power always does. So they you know, that's kind of dismissed. But we'll look at how they come to a decision about that in the second part, I guess.
So this is a part between dark bits, I guess, because the hobbits have come to Elrond through adventures. They've been attacked. Frodo's already been grievously injured. He's just spent something like 4 days unconscious because of that. And here they are in this blissful place, meeting up with lots of old friends. Everything's happy. The weather's nice. It's a lovely autumnal day. And they're going to have to set out soon on this really dangerous and dark quest. So it's sort of an interlude, I think.
Yeah, it's got a real kind of calm before the storm feel to it. And also it's a period of massive exposition.
Absolutely massive exposition. I think it's the longest chapter in the whole 3-volume book.
Speaking of massive exposition, Mark, you wanted to add something.
No, I'm reining myself in here. Oh, the only other thing I was going to say was also it's a nice bit for anyone who's read The Hobbit because Glowin makes a reappearance. And then Legolas is the son of Thranduil, who was in the first one. And Bilbo makes a reappearance. So in a way, it's kind of like for anyone who's reading it as a sequel to The Hobbit, it's kind of like, oh, here's all these familiar faces. This is great. This is connecting it with what I know so far. And then a lot of the story they talk about when they're all sharing their perspectives is recapping the story of how Bilbo got the ring in the first place. So again, that's the part of the story of The Hobbit as well. So it works like that as well, I think. No, I'm going to shut up there.
Oh, I feel like I've de-goaded you.
No.
My apologies.
Okay, no, I was going to do my Ash Nag de Berta look bit, but I could do that later.
You can do your Ash Nag de Berta bit now.
Okay, well, this is the inscription on the ring.
Do you need special clothes for it?
Yeah, no, I just need a voice filter.
Because when that's actually said in the Council of Elrond goes, nobody's ever dared speak use that the black language in this before. Place okay. before.
Okay, here we go then.
Yeah.
Ash Nas Dubartuluk. Ash Nas Gimbatul. Ash Nas Thrakatuk. Ambozum Ishi Krimbatul.
Is that one ring to rule them all?
Yeah, in the black speech.
Evil speak.
Yeah.
There he is. There's our guy. There's our resident nerd. So that's Lord of the Rings with a bit of the dark speak in there for you for a cheeky bonus. Social
and that's what's written inside the ring.
Yeah.
You can only see that when it's thrown into a fire.
I didn't.
That's a key bit. Oh, well, we'll talk about that. I think that comes into the social constructivism stuff, so we'll talk about that later.
Well, let's talk about social constructivism.
Okay.
Then. So, Rebecca, I know you've got something in the pipe for this. Do you want me to do like a quick summary of my understanding first, or do you want to just
do constructivism first for new listeners?
Okay, so does somebody want to do constructivism?
Mark, you've just volunteered yourself.
Oh, Jesus. Okay, so constructivism is basically, it's working from the idea that people have a structure about how the world works. They have their own ideas already. So they're all individuals as far as, you know, beginning, where they're beginning from with learning. And the idea of constructivist approaches is that you give them things like problems or experiences or get them making things that all are ways to add to that initial understanding. So the idea, it's why it's called constructivism, is that learners construct their own knowledge based on what they've already got in their heads. Social constructivism is they also do that through talking to each other, but there's more detail, I'm sure, which Rebecca will go into.
Yeah, I think the crucial difference between constructivism and social constructivism is constructivism. I mean, theoretically, you could do that by yourself. You can construct your own knowledge. You can build ideas. But social constructivism adds into the mix that actually you do that with other people, and you get ideas from other people. And some of that is just straightforward. People tell you things, they share their knowledge with you, and you add that into what you know, what you've experienced. But there are also much more complex, much more useful things that you can do. So you can challenge somebody's ideas. You can critique somebody's ideas. You can expand on somebody's ideas. You can ask somebody to justify their ideas. And it is basically about coming to a sort of a common understanding in your context of what the truth is at that point, and for you as a group, for you as a couple of people. And it acknowledges that throughout our lives, this is what we do. We very rarely sit and ideas float into our heads that we take on and build on. We're getting ideas from others, as a social individual. We're getting it from parents, we're getting it from relatives, we're getting it from friends, we're getting it from schools, we're getting it from random people we meet, we're getting it from media. And as I say, some of that you're just sort of assimilating, you're just taking the ideas on board. And really where social constructivism takes us to is pushing you that little bit further, not just relying on your own sense of what you've understood, but testing that against others and building on that.
Yeah, so when I've seen it discussed in an education context, it's usually around learning as a group collaboratively with, I think it's this the idea of language as a tool, isn't it? Language as a tool in learning. And then learning from authentic situations and contexts you find yourself in, and then the role of the teacher in that, or the kind of the instructor in that, being more as a facilitator of the process as opposed to didact.
Yeah, so it's very closely associated with the ideas of Vygotsky, who was writing back in the 20s and the 30s. It didn't get translated into English until the 70s, when his ideas sort of really took off and people began to build on them. And one of the things that he was talking about was definitely language as a tool. It's a tool for constructing understanding within your head. It's also a tool for constructing understanding with others. And he was also interested in something which has been picked up in another Pedagogzilla about zone of proximal development, about the idea that you can do a bit more if you're working with a more experienced other who can sort of support you to do that, and then support you to do that by yourself. So there's a lot of ideas associated with it. I mean, lots of ideas which have come up throughout Pedagogzilla. Ideas around, for example, communities of practice are very much tied up with the idea that lots of people have ideas and knowledge and skills. And when you put those together, you as an individual can expand your own skills and knowledge.
One of the problems with language as a tool is that it doesn't always work very well, because it's can be a bit of a blunt tool in that people use it in different ways, or they'll, you know, pick up a hammer and hit a screw with it because, you know, that's what a hammer means to them. We could look at transactional distance at one point. So you see that two people trying to have a conversation, and there will be between some people be a lot more distance between them as far as their ideas go, partly because they've just got different ideas, but also because the language they're using doesn't mean the same thing to both people. So it's not always a successful tool. So part of the social constructivist thing, if you're doing it right, is to come up with a common meaning for all of the words before you start anyway, and try and come up with a, you know, shared space with what those ideas mean, really.
Yeah, and again, we've seen that in Pedagogzilla, which it took us a few episodes, a few conversations to realise that Mark and I were using the same words in slightly different ways, and we had to sort of argue that out and make our point to each other and try and come to a conclusion there. I think another thing that comes out of that with language from Vygotsky was saying that when you talk, you're transforming your thoughts into words. So even if you've got internal speech, even if in your head you're sort of phrasing things, talking to yourself, it's when you actually have to put that into speech to somebody else that your ideas really come together and you begin to see, oh, yeah, I hadn't quite realised I was thinking of it that way.
Yeah.
And, oh, look, I can see a hole in my argument here.
There's nothing quite like realising you don't know something than trying to explain it to somebody else for the first time.
Exactly. And in your head, you think you've completely got it. But when somebody says, well, now explain that to me, you stumble and run into problems. It's a shift, I think, from how people have thought about learning before. People have definitely thought about learning as an individual thing which goes on in your head. And, you know, teachers might be pushing information into your head. It's basically going on in you. And what the social constructivists are saying is, no, it's much more complex than that. It's an interaction. It's a negotiation. It is profoundly social. And in fact, people have gone on beyond that to say, yeah, actually, there are theories which say it doesn't even ever end up with the individual. So the theory of distributed cognition would take that one step further and would say that sometimes the knowledge is embedded in a group or a team or a network. I'd say another nice thing about this is, speaking as a researcher, one of the things you find it really difficult to do is to look at learning taking place. Because, of course, if learning is taking place in your head, you can't see it. And that's what the behaviorists were struggling with. And the behaviorists were going, well, okay, we'll say learning is a long time change in behavior. So they had to watch out for changes in behavior. But if you say, actually, a lot of learning takes place in conversations, especially now that we're looking at online conversations which are happening in written text, which is preserved, you can actually see those moments where people change their views, change their perspective, perhaps say, oh, yeah, I understand, or rephrase something that they've heard before. So it gives us a new way of looking at learning and seeing when that learning is taking place, which is very helpful.
Yep.
I feel that we should probably move on.
I've got some questions about it that we can reflect on in the next bit, if that's all right.
Yeah.
Okay, so I was going to say, when effective social constructivism, from a teaching point of view, how important is it to have a diverse range of people in your social group, do you reckon, Rebecca?
There is a view that what you're doing is constructing the knowledge which is useful and helpful in your context. So you're looking for the people who would normally be in your context. But if you want to move further beyond that, then yes, the more diversity, I think. Not so much diversity that you've got no common reference points and so you're all just talking past each other, but definitely diversity is an important thing, I would say.
My next one is, what about status? Is there a problem with different people having different status within that social group?
You can run into problems like groupthink if you're doing things together.
Okay, here's another one. How well is it at error correcting? If it's a socially constructed idea and somebody's coming in with something that's not true, what happens? How is that actually a flaw in the whole social constructivist thing?
Well, I think that's a flaw in any teaching system, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at some of the things which are going on in certain states of America at the moment, where schools are teaching things which, from my perspective, I would say are clearly untrue. If somebody is coming and teaching you that,
right,
in any context, especially if they have power, especially that if that is backed up by the power of the state or the government, then you're going to run into problems. I'd have said one of the advantages of social constructivism is that people can challenge. You know, challenge is an important part. Justification is an important part. Producing evidence is an important part. Of course, you can set your education system up so that it doesn't support those things, but I think they're part of the system.
Yeah, I mean, I'd normally consider that part of the role of the kind of the educator, the teacher in that as well? Like if you were having kind of a facilitated social constructivist approach to your teaching, then for me, surely the teacher is kind of the error correction to perhaps the more independent learner.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Because one of the issues I've had with trying to use social constructivist approaches is students will kick back and go, why should I listen to six wrong opinions? I want you to tell me what the right one is. And it's like, oh, that's not the way this bit works.
It's kind of like a callback to problem-based learning, isn't it?
I think it certainly takes us back to problem-based learning, inquiry-based learning. If you throw students into the deep end without giving them anything to work with, you know, you're not asking a five-year-old to work out the five times table from first principles because, you know, they could waste their life doing that.
Yeah.
You tell them something, but then you might ask them to apply that to some situation they know that they can work with. The aspect of social learning that I've spent quite a lot of time looking at is the sort of conversations that people have. And I think this does take us into the Council of Elrond.
Mm.
If you put people together, Neil Mercer said there are three basic ways that they might go with their discussion. So one is they're disputational, and one person says, you know, this dress is blue, and somebody else says, this dress is gold, and they just...
You know, they'll go off just look
fundamentally,
at it.
Yeah, they fundamentally disagree.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really get you anywhere. No learning takes place. And then there's cumulative, where people keep adding pieces of information. And that's useful, and it does move you on, and it is a learning discussion. And I think that's what we see in the Council of Elrond a lot of the time. But also, you can support students to develop other techniques and to engage, to use those. You can get them evaluating the information that's been given to them, explaining, asking for explicit reasoning, getting them to critique and challenge and justify ideas. Those are techniques that you can consciously give to students, encourage them to use, and that will mean they learn more deeply, they can progress further.
Okay, and my last problem with that issue I have with it is this whole idea of coming to it with a consensus. To what extent is that consensus fake in that it's actually just a group idea dominating and it hasn't actually contributed to each individual's learning because each individual will have a different, might have a different idea and that's just been subsumed by the group consensus? How big an issue is that?
I'll be introvert with that question.
Or like, it could be introversion or it could be just somebody who's a low status and so isn't being listened to when they say stuff. Which is also spot the low status person in the room. No, but you know.
But I think the learning they will take away from it is not necessarily, you know, if the group writes down on a whiteboard or a piece of paper, you know, we have decided this is a gold dress and goes, it's definitely blue, or yeah, the world definitely still goes round.
Mm.
The thing which is going on in an individual's head is not necessarily the same as what the group is deciding. Okay. You're interacting with each other and, you know, you're using your social interaction as a learning tool, which you can gain from, but not necessarily in the same way as the rest of the group.
And the evidence suggests that you might not be necessarily enjoying it anyway.
Mm.
Like, I know some of the research I've seen suggests that students just don't like those kind of collaborative and communicative activities. But that those who do engage with them do tend to have better outcomes because of it. So you might come out of it being a bit grumpy because your idea wasn't the one that was taken forward. So you're like, oh, everything's a bit different to me. But you do come out of it with some new understandings, even if you don't particularly like them.
Yeah.
And I think that's partly because people often take away the idea that, yes, having discussions and interactions is a good thing. So they start going, but they haven't really thought out why they're a good thing, and they haven't really thought out how you support people to engage in them and how you give people the skills to engage in them. So it's not something that we necessarily do automatically. It's not innate in us that we can have brilliant learning conversations, and that's one of the roles of a teacher in that sort of situation, to support those things.
Okay, I think that sounds like a point to move on.
I was listening to the first couple in particular and thinking, these seem leading. I wonder where we're going to choose these again.
They're all lying.
And let's lead into them, into the second part of the show, where we answer our question, how does the Council of Elrond use social constructivism to plan the destruction of Sauron's ring?
Part two, the answer.
What do we want to do with this? Has somebody got like a pre-baked mega answer? What do we want to do?
Rebecca's got cumulative stuff, cumulative learning pre-baked. I think we were chatting about that, and that sounded really interesting, as it's a good example of that cumulative stuff you were talking about earlier. Do you want to kick off with that?
Yeah, I think definitely. So the Council of Elrond, we've got we're not quite sure how many people are there. There's probably about, I don't know, 10, 12 who are named and who actually are quoted within it. But there's a group of people, they're together for 4 hours, they've come from different places, they've come from different backgrounds, they've come from different experiences, and basically they spend a lot of time doing a lot of exposition. And if they lived in the modern world, you know, they could have sent along a video or a tape recording or a podcast. Here's what's going on in our area. Elrond, who says, here are thousands and thousands of years of story, which I'm going to recount to you. And it's really, really complex. So I'm going to tell you that. And then we've got the dwarves come in, say, this is what's happening at our end of the world. We've got various humans coming in saying, well, this is what's happening in our land. These are various tales that we know. We've got the hobbits come in and say, well, this is what's been happening to us recently. And we've got Gandalf saying, oh, I've been doing a bit of digging into things and this is what I know. So basically, the Council of Elrond is probably about 4 hours of loads of people doing loads of exposition. And at the end of it, they must be so bright and so alert and such morning people because at the end of it, they seem to have taken all this information in and decided what the best thing to do is. But I do think it is fairly cumulative. There's not a lot of challenge. There's not a lot of, can you give us a bit more evidence here? There's not a lot of critique. It could have been perhaps deeper, perhaps not in the time available.
Well, okay, one of the things they say is that although a lot of it was known to a lot of them, nobody knew everything. So there is a kind of key bit of sort of information sharing. And the key thing is, of course, they've got this ring and they don't really know if it's the ring or not. They know the history of the ring is that Sauron lost it to Isildur. He chopped off his hand, but then Isildur was wearing it and he was killed by orcs, Knight of the Gladden Fields. That's the Gladden Fields in the Vales of Anduin, not the ones in Chelmsford. So, yeah, so they know that the ring fell into the Anduin at some point, and then nobody really believes anything happened next. So just because Bilbo found a ring from Gollum, and then it's like, well, how did Gollum get it? How do we know that's the same ring? You know, we've got no evidence for that whatsoever, just because it's like to the Misty Mountains and nowhere near the Anduin. So how could it get from there to there? It's probably not the same ring at all. So there's kind of like having to talk around it to really establish that it's the same thing. And then there's the whole thing, well, I checked, Gandalf goes to, this is the bit about experimenting. It's like, well, I went to Gondor. I found out that Isildur didn't die straight away. He went back to Gondor and then put it into the fire. And then the thing that I said earlier, the inscription started glowing and he heated up Bilbo's ring and found this inscription, so he knows it's the same one, and that's piece of evidence links the whole thing together. So it could have just led with that, I suppose, but from a narrative point of view, it helps the reader fill in a bit of the background. But yeah, but I guess that's the point of it, is they are accumulating all these different bits of the story, trying to establish this provenance for what's there, really. And I think they come up with finally agreeing that that's what it is. So there's that consensus building, I guess.
And it's consensus building as well with the actual decision as to how to or what to do next, isn't it? It's not just one person. It's no single authority going, right, you little uns, off you tottle to do this massively perilous mission into the heart of darkness. It's a real kind of emerges as a sort of collective decision from the council, because they recognize that no individual there should really be wielding it. They definitely can't agree on that, but they form this sort of collaborative approach. They're able to send their stakeholders, their own kind of agents into that group.
And I'd say when they go into the council, they have absolutely no idea that they're going to send hobbits off with it.
Yeah.
You know, I think they think of the hobbits as fairly peripheral. Oh, yeah, they've been lucky enough to find this ring. They brought a ring to us, but, you know, us heroic types will handle it from here. And one of the things you see is that in the Council of Elrond, a lot of the people who are in the council are the people who go on with the ring, form the Fellowship of the Ring, go on to try and take it together to destroy it. But two of the hobbits aren't there at all. Merry and Pippin aren't there to hear any of this exposition. Sam's only there because he's snuck in. So it's not sort of planned out, okay, these are the guys that we think are going to solve it. We brought them all together. And they only come to that realisation during the council.
And Gimli's only there because his dad went. I mean, Gimli doesn't say anything during the council. It's his dad that does all the speaking, glowing. Boromir's only there because he lied. Because actually Faramir should have been the one to go, because he was the one with the dream. He had this dream about go to Imladris, with the halflings. And then Boromir claims, oh, I had that dream as well now, after he's heard Faramir say a few times, which is not convincing at all. He's obviously bullshitting. But nobody stands in his way because everybody likes Boromir, but he's generally considered to be a bit on the dim side by everybody. He kind of wangles his way onto it. And yeah, they're not. There's no consensus because Elrond and the elves and that decide, yes, we should destroy it. But Boromir is dead set against that, and it just goes along with the fellowship because they're going in the same direction for a big chunk of the time. And then, of course, it's not spoilers because everybody's seen it. He tries to take it at one point because he realizes that, you know, they're going to destroy it, and he wants it to defend Gondor. But he's constantly, you know, this is what I meant about the hierarchies and the sort of viewpoints that are dismissed because. So basically there's two main different sorts of men, humans, in this. There's the people who descended from Numenor, the people that lived in Numenor, which was an island that was destroyed in the Second Age, and all of their descendants are now the kings and the sort of ruling people in Middle-earth. And so, but in Arnor, it's all in the north, it's all fallen apart. There was regional wars, and the only survivors are the Rangers, and then the only surviving king is Aragorn from the descendants of the original Numenoreans. But all the people in Gondor are Numenoreans as well, their descendants, but they've kind of not devolved, but their lifespans are a bit shorter than they used to be, and they're not quite as kingly as they used to be. The line of kings has all died out. So although Gondor's this city that's actually defending a lot of the realm, it's kind of they're looked down upon a bit, and so Boromir's not really got the status he should have or thinks he should have. So there's one bit where, and this is where there is some contention, is that Gwaihir rescues Gandalf from the Tower of Isengard, flows him off, and then while he's doing it, he passes on a rumour that the people of Rohan, which are some of the, in quotes, lesser men, the non-Numenoreans, have been trading with Sauron. And so therefore, you know, they've been giving him horses and all that sort of stuff, supplying him with horses. Boromir says, I don't believe that. They're true people, they're good people, and they might not be Numenoreans, but they're still worthy, valorous people. They wouldn't do that. And he's ignored, and they go, oh, we have to watch out for these people of Rohan. But actually, Boromir's right. They haven't been doing that. Sauron's been stealing them. So there's no this error correcting. There's none of this consensus of opinions. There's ideas and positions being overruled simply because of the lower status of some of the people in the council. So as an example of how social constructivism can go wrong, it's really good as well because...
Well, so on that theme then of of social constructs. I mean, you mentioned earlier that we don't have all the hobbits in the room, but the hobbits are some of the people who are kind of very much linked to this mission. Is that another failure then? The fact that we've not got all the right people in the room? Because it feels like we've got a lot of the right people in the room on the basis that they're coming in with all this history and they're coming in with all this expertise and the ability to swing axes at things.
You're never going to have all the right people in a room, are you?
No, it was Galadriel.
Yeah, and mentioning that, you know, everybody in the room is male.
Yes.
So, you know, half the population aren't there or aren't represented in the slightest.
Yeah.
But also, as well as the One Ring, which is the bad ring, there are actually three quite good rings. You know, Elrond's got one, Gandalf's got one, and Galadriel's got one, but she's not invited over. She'd be an obvious person to get involved in these discussions or to send over review. You know, whatever sort of social constructivist setup you have, you're not going to come up with the one truth for all time.
Yeah.
You're only ever going to get to a partial truth. So I don't think that's necessarily a problem with the pedagogy.
No, I suppose it's what...
Also, does that mean it's failed the... Was it the Vorkamp test? What's the one... What's
Bechdel.
That test
the Bechdel test.
Bechdel test. Yeah.
The Bechdel test is, which Bechdel herself loathes and detests now. She wishes people would stop talking about it. But it's basically, it fails a Bechdel test if something doesn't have two women who don't talk about men, who talk about something else other than men. It is very sexist in as much as the women there are. I mean, there's no women in the Fellowship. There's this sort of whole speech about she dreads being locked away until she can't, she's too old or too used to being doing nothing to be at all constructive. So that's that one lone feminist voice that...
Given that there are three books in this,
particular book, it only passes the Bechdel test by a sliver. I don't know. I'm not saying it's brilliant. I'm just saying it has this one passage.
That's my fault, by the way, having strayed us off the topic.
I think it's all relevant because we talk about diversity because there's the five, unless you're playing Lord of the Rings Trivial Pursuit, in which case they think it's four. But you've got five races. You've got five races represented there, but no women. And it's like, and that's kind of all the way through the book.
I suppose we could also point out that there are races which are not involved in the council who might have a radically different opinion. So the orcs, the Ents wouldn't get through this story in 4 hours.
They wouldn't get through the introductions in 4 hours.
I'd be lucky if we get through this recording in 4 hours.
But the orcs who are on Sauron's side, they must have a completely different perspective on this, which we never hear about.
There's one bit. There's a bit where Shagrat and Gorbag are talking, which I think's brilliant. This hadn't really sunk in before. But there's a bit where they've just captured Frodo after he's been sort of poisoned by Shelob. And they're taken into the Barad-dûr, and they're going, oh, you just have a quick chat. So these are two lieutenants among the orcs. And all they want to do is run away, have nothing to do with the war, and live the rest of their life in peace and just get away with a bit of pillaging and torturing now and again, which is, you know, just that. But they can't because they know that wherever they go, the humans are going to try and, wipe them out. So they're stuck. So that's I wouldn't say humanizing because there's still the torturing and pillaging going on, but they're not entirely bad. Do you know what I mean? They don't want to be there any more than anybody else does, which I think is the anti-war thing coming in a bit. It's like, you know, even a lot of the Germans didn't want to be fighting in the First World War either. They just wanted to go off somewhere and do their own thing. So they might want the ring destroyed as much as anybody else, as long as they could still, have their own little bit of land set aside for them to carry on doing their own thing.
I think kind of like a Rosencrantz and Lorkstorn head or something like.
Indeed.
So, anything else on our answer? Do we want to summarise our answer?
Oh, okay. What's the question again?
I think... How does social constructivism...
How does the Council of Elrond use social constructivism to plan the destruction of the One Ring?
So by coming together, by bringing different pieces of information, by talking those through, by sharing those, by asking for clarification, for asking for evidence, for reporting on some degree of experimentation, at the end of that, the Council of Elrond has come to a decision that, yes, this is the ring. Yes, it should be destroyed.
But they do that by not being as diverse as they could be, although, as you just pointed out, you can't be completely diverse, but also by overruling dissenting voices, which is this is how they come to a decision, but it's not an all-inclusive decision because the people, the one person there who doesn't want to destroy it, doesn't get a look in. And a lot of that is to do with the fact that he's not a king. He's not, you know, he's only a Numenorean. He's not even the brightest of the Numenoreans. And so he's, you know, he's constantly sidelined throughout the whole discussion. So it's not surprising he snaps later on, really. Because
and to be fair, lots of people are sidelining each other. Like the dwarves don't trust the elves. The elves don't trust the dwarves. People look down on Aragorn because he's just this sort of unkempt tramp.
I do wonder if there's this thing that's kind of happened in there, which I think you often see in a lot of kind of group work, a lot of collaborative work, in that one person has started off with what's probably the right idea and how to tackle it, and then has to sit there twiddling their thumbs and grinding their teeth while they wait for everybody else to talk themselves around to the decision that they've already made.
Yes, that's true. And I think Elrond probably is there to start with as well, because he knows what's going on, and very few other people do, really. Yeah, so anyway.
So it feels like we've answered the question. Okay. Should we move on to the next part of the show and talk about what this might mean for people's practice?
Okay.
Part 3. Practical tips.
Okay, so social constructivism, what we've talked about so far, what we've learned, and what are our resultant tips for people who are using this in practice?
I'd say one of the things is to be aware of the different types of learning discussion you can be having, and to try to push your students towards having more exploratory discussions, which are going to lead to the deeper learning. So being aware of what those things to do are, the challenge, the critique, the evaluation, the explanation. And introducing these to your students and encouraging them to use them, supporting them to use them. I think that's some very important aspect of social constructivism.
I think finding a way to include as many voices and look for where voices may be being excluded, that even if they're not valid in that, you know, like, so for Boromir, it wasn't valid for him to think, oh, we could use this. But if you don't find a way to include them, they're not learning as much from that as they could be. So, you know, they're going off in their own direction, and that can be destructive later on. So I think monitor and reflect on how that thing has been constructed, how that conversation's gone, how that information's been shared, and look for flaws in that process where you may have sidelined or overlooked information or valued one person's position more than another's unfairly. And if there is something objective that you can get, some fact that you could go to, don't take somebody's word for it. If somebody says, oh, it's this is Isildur's ring, go, well, let's find a way to test that. If somebody says, well, the Rohirrim have been selling their horses to Sauron, go, well, before we assume they are, let's find out whether they have or not, and rely on the person that knows them better to come up with to supply the answer, or defer to him if he's got more knowledge about it. And try and be diverse as possible, really.
And I'd say that to some extent takes us over into a whole new area around decolonizing the curriculum.
Yeah.
And, I was thinking
critical pedagogy for that, because that was definitely one of the things that came up when we talked about Jesse Stommel's work on critical pedagogy a while back, is just thinking who you've got in the room, where is your decision-making coming from?
Yeah. And who you've pushed out of the room.
Yeah.
And whose knowledge you are valuing. Because you can have very diverse people in the room, but if you're not valuing their perspective, their way of thinking, then that doesn't get you very far.
Yeah, and it's kind of
Middle Earth would be a good episode.
In terms of tips, I'd say another one is the one that you always get with thinking about any form of social interaction in learning. So you get this problem-based, you get this with inquiry-based, you get this with collaborative, is not assuming that students know instinctively how to go into a group and have a valuable conversation. So things like setting up some rules, setting up some boundaries, setting up checkpoints, deciding what you're going to do if there's conflict, deciding what you're going to do if somebody's not contributing, the sort of procedures and skills that you can develop in your students, which makes it a lot more straightforward a process. And I think most students have had the depressing experience of being shoved in a corner with a random set of people and said, right, now solve this problem. And actually, you spend most of the time trying to sort the group out rather than trying to solve the problem.
Yeah.
And that's partly because you haven't been given the skills to do it, and partly because you're just being assigned a random group of people with no idea about why you're with those people or how you could benefit from that.
Yeah, framework, structure all group work ever.
And yeah. I suppose the main...
Well, you're introverted, well, thank you.
And I suppose the final thing is, if you are going to have somebody who talks too much, have them on right at the end, just before lunch, because that way they will finish more quickly in order to get something to eat.
I like
that. That's true, because one of Bilbo's great contributions to the council that we're on is keep saying, I'm quite hungry. Do you think we should wrap it up now?
Yeah, and they go, no, we should. Well, it's something like, I'm hungry, can we break for lunch? And then Elrond says, no, carry on, do your bit now, because the sooner you wrap it up, the sooner we can all go and eat, just to force him to keep his bit short, because Bilbo can go on a bit.
Yeah.
Oh, I like that. Yeah. I've got a tip as well, actually.
Oh, go on,
I want to just Vision? Cycling back to the language as a tool. I mean, one of the reasons why the Council of Elrond works is that everybody's speaking a common language. But then, of course, within language, you have kind of specific taxonomies and terms or ways of interpreting things. And it just so happens that they all happen to line up for that. But then thinking about this podcast and kind of my journey of going through and understanding just the language of pedagogy and the language related to it, it's equipped me with the understanding of the language in order to actually participate in discussions like this and understand what's going on. And without it, I wouldn't be able to contribute or understand. So I wouldn't even be able to engage in this as an activity. So I'd say just don't underrate the language as a tool aspect. And you might want to consider having that very much as like a, before you start, or as even a first step if you are facilitating this as a learning process, is making sure that everybody's on the same page with regards to what they're talking about. Okay, so that's our top tips. That's the answer to our question. What more could you possibly want, you greedy, greedy gosling? Anything else you guys want to throw in before I bring us to a close?
No, I think that's it.
Nope, I think that's it.
Well done us for not going deep nerd. Me, because I actually, ironically, couldn't remember Lord of the Rings quite as well as I thought I had, despite the fact that I watched the movies relatively recently. And Mark and Rebecca for doing a lot of research in the preparation of this and then not regurgitating the minutiae of the Silmarillion all over my ears, for which I am very, very grateful. And grateful to you too for listening. We love you lots, and we'll see you next time on Pedagodzilla. Goodbye now.
Namarie.
Oh, there's a whole other bit to this, isn't there? You can subscribe. You can subscribe to us on all of your favourite apps, feeds, iTunes, and at our website, pedagodzilla.com. You can also get in touch with us via Twitter. We're still calling it Twitter. We'll never call it the other thing. I'm at Pedagodzilla.
I'm at Mark Childs.
And I'm at Rebecca S, where the first E is a 3.
We love you a lot, and we'll see you next time on Pedagodzilla. Bye-bye now.